Now it's time to be educated and entertained by the country's most famous environmental scientist, Joey B. has researched grizzly bears, wolves, and birds of prey. He continues to travel all across America to bring you the very best that nature has to offer. Be ready to be amazed. Here's your host, Joey B.
Hello and welcome to Joey B. Outdoor Science and Nature. Man, do I have the coolest job. I travel all across America to bring you the very best that nature has to offer. I have a great show today because we have a guest, John Cifelli. He is the general manager of Unionville Vineyards. John, welcome to the show.
Joey, great to be here.
You know, John, there are questions that I've wanted to know for the longest time, and today you become the answer man. This is a good one. So Let's get into it. In the vineyard, how much rainfall is optimal for like a bountiful crop?
Yeah, grapevines are really interesting plants to work with. They're basically the opposite of most vegetables. Too much water is a bad thing for us. So you want dry conditions. You really want dry conditions around harvest time. The biggest challenges for growing wine grapes related to water is mold and mildew pressure, and also having the flavors in the grapes sort of diluted or washed out by lots of rain in around harvest time, August and September. So really, frankly, the less the better. Where we farm, everything is 100% dry farmed. We don't irrigate at all. Sometimes maybe when we put a new vine in the ground in May and it's year one for it and has a short, shallow root system, maybe we'll water in that circumstance. But generally, we're 100% dry farmed, and the less rain, the better.
Now, when you say the less rain, the better, is that throughout the entire season or just toward harvest?
Really the whole year. If you have a lot of rainfall in May, June, and July, really once the foliage starts to grow on the vine after bud break, you're under the risk of mold and mildew developing. So the less rainfall, the less humidity, the less moisture evaporating from the floor of the vineyard up into the canopy zone, really just the less moisture, the better.
Awesome. Well then, and this goes to where you're located. What type of soil is the best for growing grapes, and do you have that?
New Jersey is an interesting place to grow grapes because there's lots of different terrain, a lot of different geology, and a lot of different climate zones. I think there might be four different USDA hardiness zones from north to south across the state. There's a wildly different accumulation of growing degree days that occurs from southern New Jersey to the Cape May Peninsula all the way up to Sussex County. Where we are in central New Jersey, Hunterdon County, we have clay-based soils that are great at water retention, and they also have some rocky elements, some deposit from glacial era, interesting stuff for the vines to play in. When it comes to the perfect conditions or the perfect soils to grow grapes, I wouldn't say that there really is the perfect soil to grow in, just that different varieties are going to be acclimated differently to different soils, and perhaps you're going to change your growing practices based on what you've got underneath the surface of the earth there.
Great answer, man. Now, question is, how did Unionville Vineyards, how did they begin?
Unionville was planted in 1988. Prior to that, the land, that property was in some sort of agricultural production dating back to 1858 is when the farmstead was founded. It was in dairy, it was pasture, horse pasture, peach, and grain. So this is the fourth or fifth different iteration of agriculture on that property. And we added more vines in the 90s and the early 2000s. And then in the early 2000s, we also planted a property called the Amwell Ridge Vineyard across the street, as well as the Pheasant Hill Vineyard, which is about 10 miles southeast in Hopewell, on the north side of Hopewell. And in 2017, we planted another property called Coventry on the Great Road in Princeton. So we have four unique sites between East Amwell, where the winery is, Hopewell Township, and Princeton.
Now that you're mentioning all that, the question that comes to mind is, so you're going to harvest from those places. Is all the wine made right at Unionville Vineyards?
Yes. So Unionville in East Amwell in Hunterdon County is where everything's processed. So we grow on the different sites, but all the wine is made in East Amwell.
All right. Now, I know that there's many people that work in the vineyards. Tell me some of the specific jobs that occur there.
Sure. So our vineyard crew is seven different people. The vineyard manager is Rachel White. She has a master's degree from the University of Georgia. She's worked with some of the top minds on the East Coast viticulture, Kane Hickey and Tony Wolf. And her job is basically the total organization and the planning and the management, putting different people on different tasks, recognizing people's skill sets. So she's sort of the oversight and the guidance of the vineyard. And also she really has the academic acumen to really understand how grapevines grow. And in the East Coast, another issue that we contend with because of all the rainfall is vigor or too much foliar growth. Getting the vines in proper balance between foliar growth and ripening great grapes. So there's some tricks to the trade and some cultural practices of the way that we actually apply the human element to grape growing that she's really, really skilled at. And so she's sort of at the top of the vineyard management. And then we have Alvaro Cruz, who leads some of the tasks and the jobs that are assigned to the crew for the day. And he's also our primary spray operator. So he makes sure that the vines are being taken care of as far as anything that we need to spray for mildew, or occasionally sometimes we have to spray for insects, certain pests that can be very damaging. And sometimes we try to sort of absorb what the pests will bring to the vineyard. And sometimes they're a little bit too much to contend with and they have to be knocked down. So he has a really important job there. Chris Kelly is our technician and our mechanic of sorts. And so he knows how to take care of all the small machinery and the tractors and things like that. And then we have crew, some very long-term farmers that have been with us for over a decade. And we bring in some people year to year, usually college students, once in a while, a high school student who has a particular interest in agriculture, farming, viticulture. And they do all the hand-to-hand combat with the vines. So we're talking about leaf pulling and shoot thinning and canopy management and weed whacking under the vine. It's a laborious, tedious year-round process, and most of the work's done by hand.
You've discussed that. What type, like when you're deciding what type of grape to grow, so how do you make that decision? And are you looking for different wine tastes from around the world that says, okay, we want to grow this specific grape? So how does that come about?
Sure. Well, you definitely want to look at benchmark expressions of different varieties. So we grow a lot of Chardonnay and Pinot Noir and blends that are from Rhone varieties. So the Rhone Valley's in Southeast France. And you want to look at benchmark wines. So we're drinking and tasting the great Burgundies, the great Pinot Noirs and Chardonnay of Burgundy. And we're tasting wines of the Rhone Valley, Carotti and Cornas. So we're working with varieties like Syrah, Viognier, Marsan, Roussan, Pique Blanc, Cunoise, and we grow these varieties on all of our different sites. Now, as far as what we decided to do, you look at what your soil is, you look at what your climate is, and you look around the world and you say, what has thrived in similar circumstances, similar situations, and what might be applicable to our growing conditions here? And it might take a decade or 15 years before you really understand whether or not there's enough similarity for what thrives in one place and makes a world-class wine there, whether or not that can translate to the growing conditions here. There are thousands of grape varieties all around the world. And when you make these decisions, you look at that and you think about what's going to grow here, what's going to make great wine here. You also have to think about what's going to be marketable here and what's going to sell here. So most of our wines are sold through the tasting room, and that gives us a little bit more leeway as far as what we can grow, because if it's a lesser known variety, as long as we're in front of a guest in the tasting room and we're able to explain what it is, why we grow it, what they're tasting for, what they would pair it with on the table, people are going to enjoy that wine and you're going to be able to sell it that way. If we took a very lesser known grape variety that maybe isn't grown widely in the United States or understood or recognized in the market here in the Jersey, New York, Philadelphia area, trying to sell that outside of our own tasting room would probably be pretty difficult.
All right. Now, up on the hill, and I'll call it the hill, and that's where I met Rachel, you have the new vineyard up there, the new piece of it. When will that actually be in production, so to speak? When will you be able to harvest from that?
Well, some of it is. So some of that spot that you saw was planted in 2018. And then the rest of it was planted in 2020. So last year, we took a really small crop in the third leaf or the third year of growing. Usually it takes 3 to 4 years before you'll start to take a crop from a vineyard site. Prior to that, you want to drop the flowers, drop the young clusters. You want the plant to really put its energy into the roots and into the infrastructure of the plant. So the trunk and the roots, and you want to build that plant up for long-term success. You don't want to risk a brutally cold winter and having still somewhat weak or juvenile plant that's going to perhaps not survive a deep cold winter injury or be susceptible to disease in a successive growing season. So we took a small crop from 2/5 of that vineyard, which was planted in 18, and that was Pinot Noir and Cabernet Franc. And then this last year, spring of 2020, we planted it to Marsan, Roussan, and Pico Blanc, three different varieties that are indigenous to the Rhone Valley. And we'll take the first harvest from those vines in 2022.
When you planted that, do you actually purchase cuttings from a specific, another vineyard somewhere saying, hey, this is the wine we want to grow, and you purchase the actual cuttings? Like, how was that done?
It's a nursery. It's a commercial nursery that serves the wine industry, the vineyard industry. And there's one located in the Finger Lakes that we source from. There's also one located in California that we source from. So the nurseries, their wine's made in all 50 states in the United States. So although the majority of the focus of the industry is out in California and on the West Coast, you can call up a nursery that usually does business on the West Coast and say, I need 3,000 Marsan vines. I need them grafted onto this specific rootstock, and I need them shipped out to New Jersey. And if you give them enough lead time, usually what we're growing on rootstock-wise in New Jersey or on the East Coast might be different from what they're looking for out on the West Coast. So sometimes that'll require custom grafting, and they're basically making those plants from scratch for us, but they can do it. And that's where we get our vines from.
Now, are they all grafted? Like all
yes.
Your varieties?
Yes. So in the United States, particularly in the East, there is a pest, a louse that lives in the soil called phylloxera. And it eats the roots of Vitis vinifera. Vinifera being the species of grape that are on the top of the grafted plant. So vinifera is the noble varieties that you're probably most familiar with: Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Cabernet Franc, anything from France, basically, that you've ever heard of, or Italy or Germany is a vinifera variety. If you see it on a restaurant wine list or in a liquor store, it's a vinifera variety. And during the colonial era, these grape varieties, these cultivars, were being brought across the ocean and planted in the colonies, and they were not surviving. And it was thought for a while that it was related to the harsh winters and the weather in Virginia and Pennsylvania and New Jersey. But eventually a scientist realized that it was actually a pest that was eating the roots of the plant. Unfortunately, we didn't realize this until the pest was hopping boats and going back to Europe, and it wiped out a lot of the vineyards in Europe. Wow. So the solution was to graft the vinifera, or the top wood of the varieties that we drink, onto American roots. So they went out into the woods and they found native grapevines growing wild in the woods. And eventually that became the cultural practice here, where we graft the vinifera onto American rootstock. And that's how we're able to grow these varieties, not only in the United States, but even back in Europe, as much of Europe is now planted on American rootstock.
That is super interesting. And this show is brought to you by Ramsey Outdoor Stores. Whether you shop online or one of their stores, your experience will successfully gear you up for your next adventure. Go to RamseyOutdoor.com. Now, if there is a drought, because we're talking about the amount of rainfall, say there's a severe drought one year, how does that affect the wine itself? And then how do you compensate for that?
There's no need to compensate. We love droughts.
So really, the drier the better is what you're after.
At least in our part of New Jersey. Now, further south in, say, the Outer Coastal Plain or the Cape May Peninsula, because those soils are sandier and they drain much faster, it's likely that the vines there will struggle in a drought scenario. And I know that there are many vineyards in southern New Jersey that do irrigate, and they do have drip irrigation built into their trellising system. But where we are, again, because the clay soils of central and the rockier soils of the clay soils of northern New Jersey, because they retain moisture better, there's really very, very little risk of drought intolerance in a plant that's established. So the most recent drought year, I think, was 2010. And those wines were incredibly concentrated, incredibly powerful. You could fool anybody by thinking that they were wines of the Napa Valley. They were powerful, ripe, higher alcohol than usual for New Jersey. They were really atypical for what New Jersey wine usually is. Some people like that style. Some people thought it's too much. I mean, if you've come to enjoy East Coast wines, it's not really what you look for. But it was interesting to see what New Jersey wines could be in an extreme low rainfall year.
This is what I love about this show is when I bring a guest on, I learn so much about this. I already mentioned to you that my dad's 94-year-old, came from Italy, family, made winemaking, and he's looking forward to listening to this show as well. Now, question I have for you, we spoke a little bit about some of the pests. Do you have any animals that affect? And I know that you have deer fencing up. Talk about that.
Last year, we scouted one of our sites, and the Syrah looked beautiful. And we were so excited. All right, we'll be back in 2 days. So we scouted it on Saturday. We took samples. We went back to the lab. We ran the analysis. The numbers were right where we wanted. The flavors were great. We went back on Monday. And in the course of 48 hours, a family of raccoons ate over a ton of Syrah. And this is stuff that's worth $3,000 or $4,000 a ton. You're talking about thousands of dollars of loss to raccoons. The groundhogs, they get into the vineyard and they dig holes that the tractor can collapse a burrow into and throw the whole tractor. And, you know, we've had windows get smashed against a trellis post. Birds are a huge pest. We net everything. We net all 42 acres have bird netting installed on them. We have to go through the vineyard and we have to roll that from the bottom up over the fruit zone and clip it midway up the trellis into the canopy. So birds, raccoons, everything's deer fenced. Yeah, we definitely combat against the fauna of Hunterdon County.
And well, here's another question for you then. Do sulfites naturally occur on the grapes?
No.
So no, you're adding, and again, all wineries would add some sulfite to their mixture. Is that the go?
Well, you add SO2 at various points in the winemaking process. You could do it at the beginning. You can do it towards the end when it's time for bottling. But yes, when you see contained sulfites, that's something that's added to the wine. It's really misunderstood and much maligned. People that say that they have an allergic reaction to sulfites are usually mistaken. Usually they're having a reaction to histamines, not sulfites. If someone has a sulfite reaction or sulfite allergy, you have to understand that the concentration of sulfur in a finished wine on a liquor store shelf or in a winery, the concentration is much, much lower than a lot of other foods that they likely eat. If you drink wine and you say you're having a sulfur reaction, you probably can't have trail mix. You can't eat dried fruits, you know, berries, raisins, things like that. You know, that stuff all has sulfur at higher concentrations for the same reason. It's basically a preservative.
Yeah, no, and that I knew. I just didn't know if it was a naturally occurring, and that's, you just cleared that up for me. So now when it's harvest time, like, what says to you it's harvest time, and can you discuss the process of harvesting?
Sure. So in the weeks leading up to harvest, we're out in the vineyard. We're obviously looking for visual clues, which is that the vine will stop growing foliarly up at the top of the canopy. There will not be continued vigor or growth. No new leaves will be growing. That sends a signal that the vine is now putting its energy into reproduction, which is what berries basically are, grape berries are. And we look for a process called veraison, where the grapes change color. All grapes are green in June and most of July. And then in late July or early August, the white grapes will turn from green to gold and red grapes will turn from green to red. And that's when the birdies start looking for them too. And that's when we have to hurry up with the nets. And then we'll go through and we'll sample. So when you sample, you walk down a row, you try to do it blind. You don't look at what you're picking. You put your hand in through the net and you'll pull out some berries from the top of a cluster and some from the bottom of the cluster and one from the middle of the cluster. And then you'll go down a plant and you'll do the same thing. And you'll take from clusters on the left and clusters on the right, and you go down the whole row. And basically you try to come up with a few hundred berries, and you bring it back to the lab and you crush up the juice and you look at it through a spectrometer to tell you the BRICS or the sugar concentration, the soluble sugars in the juice. You can run tests to understand what the acid level is as well. And then of course you want to pick for taste. So what's really interesting is that in different places of the world, ripeness, which has really two components. There's technical ripeness, which is your level of sugars and your level of acids. And then there's your phenolic ripeness, which is how developed are the flavors, have the harsh or bitter flavors, the astringent flavors that can be in the skins and in the seeds, which you want to really chew and crunch on and break apart. And you want to sense that, you want to taste that. And when is the astringency and the bitterness gone away? That gives you an idea physiologically if the berry is ready and if the wine is ready. At the same time, if you wait too long, the acids might drop out, and so the juice may be out of balance. The chemistry might not be quite right for making ideal wine. You might need to acidify. Out on the West Coast, where things get very, very, very ripe before some of the phenolics adjust appropriately for taste, your BRICS or your soluble sugars could be so high that if you fermented that juice straight to wine, the wine would come in 16-17%. And so they have to actually add water, and they have to dilute everything to water it down to bring it down to 14-15% alcohol, potential alcohol, when they go through the fermentation process. So it's interesting how the flavors of grapes change at different rates and at different times relative to the chemistry of the grape in different places, based on how hot are your days, how cool are your nights, how long is your growing season, when did the vine activate and start to grow? Is your growing season long and moderate, or is it short with lots of really, really hot days, but spring comes in fast and fall comes in fast? So a lot of different ways that the grapes can ripen. And then you ask for the process of harvest. So once we make the decision that it's time to go, we'll try to adjust the crew and acclimate them to working earlier rather than later, which really works because it's hot come late August and September. And the work of harvest is hard. It's all done by hand. And so we try to pick at night or start at 3 or 4 in the morning. We try to get the grapes in cold. We try to really get as much fruit in as possible, as quickly as possible before the day starts to warm up. Just wines just taste better, juice tastes better when the grapes aren't tired. If you've ever picked lettuce or peas in the garden at peak temperature in the afternoon in the summertime, and you taste it, the lettuce can be bitter, the peas can be bitter, versus if you pick them first thing in the morning, 6-7 o'clock, where there's a little bit of sweetness to it. Same kind of thing happens with the grapes, and ultimately that translates to a more delicious wine.
Yeah, well, something I filmed with an organic gardener. And we did something on harvesting, and just exactly what you said is you want to pick early in the morning, as early as you possibly can, for the best taste. And
right,
you just described that. So the question is, what's the optimal time to prune grapes? What time of the year?
Well, the pruning has to be done before they de-acclimate from winter temperature and come out of dormancy. So really, you want to wait as long as possible. As soon as you make a cut on a vine, you are opening up a wound, and you're creating a spot where fungus spores could get in. You don't want that period of time to go on any longer than it has to. And you also don't want to take a plant and make all these cuts and prune it all back before the wintertime starts. In the fall, when the plant goes into dormancy, the canes harden off. So the vertical stems, basically, that all the leaves and the grapes grow off of, the canes or the shoots that grow vertically, they'll die, basically, up at the top. The further away you are from the trunk and sort of the vitality of the plant, they'll die off. So if you cut back and you cut back and you cut lower and you cut lower all the way down to where it's going to grow in the next season, you're exposing that small little part of what you want to grow to next year, maybe you're only leaving two or three buds on there, and those are sensitive, and you sort of want that the rest of that cane to feel the cold temperature, and to be the part that dies, so that down at the bottom, the part that you're going to need next year for the next growing season, you can't have that die off. So you wait until as late as possible. We do most of our pruning in January and February. We stretch into March when we can, at this time of year in early April. Now, the plant's deacclimating, there's sap flowing, there's water coming through it. And it's getting to be a little bit too late. So basically you have to get everything done at this point, to set the plant up for success for the next growing season.
All right. Now, here's the most important thing. Tell me about all the wines at Unionville. So discuss any of the wines. I've had the opportunity, I mentioned to you that I tasted the Revolutionary Red, the Pinot Grigio, which, by the way, I'm not a big white guy, but the Pinot Grigio was superb. I really like that one. So tell me about your wines.
Sure. So we focus on Chardonnay and Pinot Noir are two of our main varieties. The Chardonnay, we grow Chardonnay at what we call Home Vineyard right in East Amwell. We grow it at the Pheasant Hill Vineyard in Hopewell. We grow it at Coventry Vineyard in Princeton. And what we love to do, we do this with Chardonnay, we do this with Pinot Noir, we do this with Syrah. We have the same varieties growing at different sites. And we think that they're all special sites. They have different geology. They have different aspect and slope and direction of slope and steepness of slope. So the grapes all grow differently. And obviously they're all different latitudes going from East Amwell to Hopewell down to Princeton. So length of day, your angle of slope will also affect the length of sunlight, the duration of sunlight over the course of the day. So all these sites are unique and different. And we love to express that difference of place in the wine. So in good years, we will keep the Home Vineyard Chardonnay and the Pheasant Hill Vineyard Chardonnay and the Coventry Vineyard Chardonnay. We'll keep them all separate. We'll pick them separate, ferment them separate, barrel them separate. And if the wine is exemplary and they do really communicate differences of place, we will bottle them separately. And then in the tasting room, you can taste the three different Chardonnay from the three different places. We repeat this with Pinot Noir. We repeat this with Syrah. We repeat this with Viognier. We've got all these varieties growing at all these different unique sites. So Chardonnay and Pinot Noir are sort of the core focus of the portfolio. And then I mentioned the Rhone variety. So Rhone is the other paradigm of Unionville. So we have Syrah and Viognier, and some other lesser known varieties also growing at these different locations. We do Pinot Grigio. We have a Bordeaux red blend that is Cabernet Franc and Cabernet Sauvignon. We make a delicious port wine that we release every December for the holidays. We got a lot of different things, but really we do have a pretty strong focus at this point, now approaching 30 years of being a winery, that we think that Burgundy and Rhone is what is best suited for what we're doing here in Central Jersey.
And experience is what life is about, and you have that 30-year experience to do that. So if people, speaking about experience, if someone visits Unionville Vineyards, what kind of experience could a visitor expect there?
So our tasting room is by appointment on Fridays through Mondays. So Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, you visit the tasting room, you make appointment in advance, and you're going to taste through six or seven wines in the flight. You pick them out. Our associates are incredibly professional and experienced and passionate, and they love talking about the wines and the places and the sites of Unionville and our practices here. We're all really proud of what we do here, and we make great wine. We're one of Food & Wine Magazine's top 500 wineries in the United States. We have the only red wine ever to score 90 points or better from New Jersey in Robert Parker's Wine Advocate. So we've got a great pedigree. We've got a beautiful tasting room built in the 19th century barn that is now the winery and the tasting room. We sell delicious foods from the Blauenberg Bistro, a new cafe that just opened up east of Hopewell in Montgomery Township. And they outfit our tasting room with sandwiches and charcuterie boxes and cheese boards and salads and all sorts of good things. So people can visit, they can do a tasting, they can grab some snacks, head out to our picnic area, and hopefully take some wine home, join our wine club. We've got a club, and our club members get access to special wines, members only releases. special events, special tastings, library tastings, all sorts of good things.
All sorts of good things. So can people purchase Unionville Vineyard wines online?
Sure. UnionvilleVineyards.com. And we have about half the portfolio there at any given time. A lot of our wines are a really small batch. We'll only bottle two or three barrels worth. So you're talking 50 or 75 cases. We really like people to taste and experience those in the tasting room. So I would suggest that that people visit, see what they like, talk through things with the tasting room staff, and then thereafter, check out the website and see which ones you can pick up if you don't want to take the trip. Several of our wines are for sale in Wegmans, Central Liquors in Flemington carries them, all the Basil Bandwagon locations. And Clinton, they all carry our wines. So there's lots of ways and places to find our wines.
That is a good thing, because I do like your wine. So it's great that people can get out there and get some good quality wine from New Jersey. So, John, I learned so much today, and I just wanted to say thank you very much. And I look forward to visiting the vineyard very, very soon.
Had a great time.
Hey, thank you, sir. Have a good day. Until next time, enjoy life's adventures.
You can follow all of my adventures online at joeybee.tv. That's joeybee.tv. And a very special thank you to the men and women of our armed forces for keeping us free, and for our police and firefighters for keeping us safe. May God bless America. Until next time, this is Joey B. Enjoy life's adventures.